How are you most like your brother, Matthew?
Oh, I always think about how I'm so different than him. We're both very empathetic. I think that's something that runs from my father to my brother to me and to my son. We're little empaths, and we can kind of smell and absorb other people's emotions.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Melissa Stevenson about her memoir, Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. Melissa eloquently describes her process of sifting through memories to knit together a compassionate and honest narrative. Matthew sounds like a character, and the book is dedicated to him, and he committed suicide in 2000. As I was reading, it's true, you spend much of the first part of the book explaining your differences. Why was this important to you to establish that from the get-go?
Our differences?
Yeah.
I think growing up, I had a basic insecurity, and I looked to him as the kind of person I should be or wanted to be. He was a bright light, and I was kind of a little introvert, a little peculiar, and on the edges of things. So I really looked to him as a sign of who I wanted to be without realizing that we all come into the world with different gifts, and maybe just owning what we're given is the way we shine. But I didn't get that when I was little.
Sure. And you call yourself the Petite Tornado. What did this look like growing up?
Much like my own daughter, that has come back to roost in my life for sure. I was a big feelings kid, and I was very driven. The things I wanted very intensely, and I was a pot that boiled over regularly. Not so much with anger, but shame or hurt or upset, whatever it might be. I was a kid who had to vent her emotions, and you know, everyone would know how I was feeling in those big feeling moments.
There were times and scenes when I felt almost protective of you as a child. And in thinking about the craft of writing, how does a writer learn to write both honestly about oneself, particularly about their flaws, but without making themselves pitiful or repulsive to the reader?
I think part of it is, as an older, more mature person, being able to look back at your younger self with both clarity and compassion. Mm-hmm. So for me to look back with the knowledge that I have now and be able to cast that on my former self and look at myself as a child, much the way I'd look at one of my own children now, to bring that compassion to it is key. And to have the wisdom of the adult narrator is key. But also just trying to stick to the facts, stick to the details, kind of put those experiences out there with the feelings and the details without judgment. And then the reader is able to make their own decisions.
I want to get to the details about memory in a bit, but first I want to have you read a little section about the difference between you and your brother.
At the dinner table on a rare evening when my father came home from work on time to join us, he praised Matthew for pulling a D up to a C, which was probably an oversight on my brother's part. He could ace tests without studying, so failure took a real effort. My father went on about how good it was to see the old grades coming up. Our mother nodded empathetically, reinforcing Dad's words with her listener noises. Matthew stared at them like they were stupid, and my face turned pink over my plate of microwaved peas and chicken. I earned all A's, all the time. I worked hard for them, and when I hit a mental roadblock, I collapsed into hot tears. So disgusted with myself that I couldn't lip-sync a single song until I'd mastered fractions or the art of the book report. Our parents marveled at how they brought such different children into the world, and Dad, who does not believe in coincidence, would later suggest that our differences were cosmically ordained for our spiritual growth. Whether our natures were so disparate by luck or by design, there is no doubt that Matthew was my perfect foil. He did whatever he wanted, and everyone loved him, while I ran my tires bare trying to do everything right, a single-mindedness that put a serious dent in my likability.
I love the specificity of that moment in time. And when I was reading your book, I was thinking about how, as writers, we are accountable to our memories. Because there's another memory you share in which your brother is throwing Chinese stars at your head as you stand against an oak tree. And the way you would tell it as a child is that he tied you to the tree, which you later correct as an adult narrator. And I want to know, where are the lines between how we remember it and how it happened objectively?
Writing this book was one long exercise in trying to go back and find the truth in memories, many of which I'd already kind of worn ruts in. I think they say the first time you remember something, it's the freshest. And the more we re-remember that moment, the more we revise it or rewrite it. And it was interesting to me, some of the memories that had turned into stories that I told over time, like the throwing Chinese stars at my head. I'm sure that's one I told to friends in my 20s as an example of a here's my crazy brother story. Yeah. I had to go back as an adult and think, oh, that was the creative writer in me. I don't think I was actually tethered. It was even worse. I was perfectly willing.
Right.
And just stood there on command.
Right.
And that actually is the more interesting story once you go back and hold yourself to a certain level of honesty about those details.
What was the process of trusting your memory and also that you could write your way through this book? Because it's emotional.
Yes. I'd say it took about 3 years for me to accept that I was writing a book and to have the confidence to think that I could write this book. From the moment he died, I knew there would be a book one day, if I could bring myself to do it, that would be about him and about me, this book essentially. For years, I couldn't touch that material. And then I actually started writing this when I was working, ironically, for Harcourt, the publisher, for their textbook division. And things were slow. The economy was crashing in 2008, I believe. And we had all this time where we needed to look busy. And so I started to write these little flash creative nonfiction pieces. And I could write these tiny little memories. A lot of them have been absorbed in this final draft. But I couldn't sit down and write a narrative about my brother's death. That was overwhelming. And it wasn't really until I latched on to, I knew I needed a shaping device of some sort. And I thought, if I can't tell the whole story, and I've written 200 pages of these little memories, what could I write about? Oh, cars.
Yeah, how did the structure and theme of cars come to be?
Really, it was getting to that point where I knew I had so much material, but I didn't know how to shape it. Mm-hmm. And in fiction, you have plot. Of course, you've got narrative and memoir as well. But I'd latched onto this idea of needing some kind of shaping device. I needed to be able to write about this story without looking the main subject directly in the eye. And cars had always been a big thing in my youth, in my family. They were central to me and how I wanted to live. And I just tripped upon it one day. Okay, what if I just follow the cars? And I made an outline of the different cars we'd had and then realized, oh, of course, I end up with his car as well. And then I have to wrestle the cars after his death. And so that just became the framework for the narrative.
And the metaphor then is inherent between, you know, driving and freedom and leaving, and also this sense of being driven and having ambition. And you link ambition and love. And one of the lines you write is, "The curse of being born ambitious is that I loved most those who showed few signs of loving me back." What does this look like to you, maybe now in retrospect or in the rear view?
Definitely a search for approval. And taking for granted the approval I had naturally, my mother's sort of unconditional love, and I'm sure my father's as well, although he didn't show it as overtly. And so I saw this brother figure who was larger than life and was a master at tormenting, you know, in a good-natured way and withholding approval. And it tapped into that sort of ladder rung part of my personality where, what about his affections? What about his attention? Wouldn't that be something?
And the main case made throughout the book is that he could have sort of cared less about you. But what did you discover through the grief process, but also through the process of writing the book about your true relationship or the nature of your relationship?
Two different things there. I think it becomes clear in the book, as it became clear to me, the older we got, the more I realized he wanted a connection as well, the more we outgrew those childhood selves and that sense of competition, maybe for our parents' approval, for their support, and unlimited resources in our household. I think as we outgrew that, it became clear that we very much wanted a connection, both of us. And there's little moments in the book that kind of show that. But we didn't really know how. We didn't come from the most emotive family. My mother was perhaps very emotive, but we didn't have wonderful models for connection, for that kind of connection. So while we both wanted that, we had these very shy ways of going about it, which in hindsight are meaningful and endearing to me. Writing the book and the connection I felt with him, which might be a weird thing to say with someone who's passed, but connecting with those memories of him and looking back at him as an older person, very much the way I looked at my younger self as I wrote this, you know, I had so much more compassion and understanding. And there's little moments, one of them I can think of, in a scene at his wedding, he was already tattooed from neck to knuckle by then, and I surprised him by getting a tattoo myself on my chest, which is a pretty bold place for your second tattoo. And I remember thinking that he would be so proud of me for that, and he kind of looked down, and he looked a little regretful, and he said, yeah, that's nice. And it really wasn't until I explored that memory as the adult writer that I realized, oh, he didn't want for me the life that he was making for himself. He wanted something, I'm sure, that he thought was better. So it was really neat to go back and have that adult compassion for him and look at him as a younger person instead of my older brother.
I want to go back to the cars. Mm-hmm. I think as a writer, it can be risky when we rely on scaffolding. And I'm wondering, how did you know where the lines were so that it didn't become either overwhelming or cheesy, or that it would somehow slip off the radar to structure the book around the cars that you were riding in or driving?
That took a lot of time and revision. While I always felt very at home writing about the cars, and there's pages on the cutting room floor where I tell you more than you ever wanted to know about certain types of engines and makes and models of cars. Really, the structure was juggled in revision. Originally, this had a sort of braided narrative where you started in childhood, and then the next chapter would be Missoula, Montana, and I'm a young married person. Mm-hmm. So with the guidance of a smart agent and a wonderful editor, we kind of took that braid apart, tackled it chronologically. And then I just always kept the cars in mind as a loose tether. I tried not to adhere too strictly to, we're just going to tell you about cars. And always remember, the cars give it the structure. They're definitely the touchstone emotionally, but they're an excuse to tell or a way to tell the larger story.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Melissa Stevenson about her memoir, Driven, a white-knuckled ride to heartbreak and back. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Melissa will explore alternate endings for grief and healing.
one of the other ways the book is structured in three sections. In the first section, there's chronology about growing up, and there's also these flashes to a third person day of your brother's suicide. And I'm wondering if you'll read us one of those sections.
August 6, 2000. I wonder what memories ran through my brother's mind that last Sunday in Georgia when he was still alive, if any. I've imagined that day for years now, stitching together a story I can understand from the evidence, what his friends said, and memories of the Matthew I knew. A story, in the end, is something more than nothing. I know this, he never liked Sundays. When we were kids, Sunday meant getting up and getting dressed and trying to sneak candy during the long sermon at our Presbyterian church. Once Matthew grew up, Indiana Sundays meant locked booze coolers and downtown closed up the way real cities do, only for Christmas. Once he moved to Georgia, Sundays meant hangovers, a stranger's makeup on his pillowcase, and a day off from his job running garbage with nothing to do but sweat. As the sun shines through his curtained window the morning of August 6th, heating up the trailer hours before he feels ready to wake, the light tints his closed lids gold, and he fights and fights until his head comes alive in spite of him, as dense and unsteady as a sack of wet concrete. He looks at the collection of cups on the bedside table, empty, his head throbbing now. He sits up slowly, amazed how many joints in a body can hurt at once. The dog's tail beats joy into the linoleum floor over the side of him conscious. He thinks about last night, how he was too drunk to bring a girl home, to even remember. He'd hit the bars downtown. Near closing time, he took a rest on a bench, and the ground thwacked him awake, and he crawled up and rested again. Now, another Sunday, alone, with the quiet.
What was it like for you to inhabit that day?
All those sections were written over the course of one day, I think, and that came very late in the drafting process. I think the reason they came so quickly is that's what grief is in a nutshell. Sometimes trying to put yourself in the shoes of the person you lost or piece together what happened. So once I gave myself permission to creatively inhabit that day in that space, I knew all those details. They were absolutely burned into my memory. And that's how trauma works for many people, even though I wasn't there. The experience of losing him was traumatic. And I tried to stitch together what that day was like for him with all the details that I gathered from friends who were there, different stories that were told, and what I saw when I went back to his trailer after he died to take care of things. It was a cathartic experience, actually, once I sat down to write those sections, because I was able to take all those details that had kind of haunted me and put them in a place.
What would you offer, you know, in words or sentiments to those who have lost loved ones or friends to suicide?
I read a passage in a book by Glennon Doyle recently called Love Warrior, and the little passage was, grief is love's souvenir. And I keep that in mind. Sometimes grief feels like a failure. Sometimes missing someone who, on some level, didn't want to be here can feel like a failure. I'd back up and unpack that and say that people who kill themselves don't necessarily not want to be here. And so to be kind to yourself and to know that grief is the cost of love, and loving someone is never a failure.
In the second and third sections, you begin to introduce alternate endings. And one that stuck out to me goes like this. Consider this. You went to grad school in Iowa instead of Texas and came to hate corn stalks and snow instead of fire ants and humidity. To distract yourself, you ran off with a writer 15 years your elder and spent the rest of your life revolving around his voice. Where did that imagining come from?
Oh, I don't know if I want to say. Definitely in grief, I had that experience of feeling untethered, which was a very free feeling, but not really comforting. It's beyond logic, but if I had to apply some kind of logic to it, the thinking was, if you can wake up one day and check out of the world, certainly I can wake up one day and step out of my marriage, step out of the state of Texas. It made my life choices feel so broad and open and gave me this feeling that anything was possible. And I think anyone who's been through an MFA program or any kind of creative writing program, sometimes teachers are amazing characters. And that probably just came from watching some older writer and harboring a little mini crush and just thinking, what if? Now the older me is able to look back and say, if you had done that, you know, that person probably would have eaten you alive. And it wouldn't have resulted in the journey this book ultimately has been for me, which is taking the time to quite literally find my voice on the page and then more figuratively in my life, you know, standing on my own, not in relationship to a man, and hearing what I sound like.
Was there something healing about writing these possibilities of endings?
Those also all came to me in one day. That was on the first draft experience, so it was pretty early in the process. And I think I was trying so hard to sit down and work diligently every day and follow this chronological narrative. I'm also a poet. I'm a fiction writer. And I think one reason I skip between genres is to regain that sense of play that is critical to creativity and to creating something that's lively on the page. I'm not even sure where they came from, but once that phrase came to me, consider this, and I started to write one, they all flew out. I had tons of them, and only some have ended up in the book, and they've, you know, been revised and changed, and much like you would with a poem, I played with placement, moving them all around like puzzle pieces. But for me, those little sections really speak to grief. What if one thing had been different? What if I'd done X instead of Y? Would this person still be alive? And what would that mean? And who would I be?
What did you learn about the process of grief through writing this book?
What I knew going into the writing process, and one of my main reasons for wanting to write the book, is that grief is very isolating. At least it was for me. In our culture, we don't make room for it. We don't take time for it. We don't know how to handle other people who are grieving. I really felt like I was someone with a contagious disease, only one that I wasn't allowed to talk about because it would frighten other people. I was afraid to write this book in large part because I thought, who would ever want to go there with me? What reader is going to want to read these details that haunt me? And what could I possibly have to offer them? The great surprise of the drafting process and revising and working with this is realizing there's a lot of light and humor in there as well. That shadow, right? You can't have a shadow without light. And both of those qualities are in the book, but ultimately the book should take you on a journey that is what grief felt like to me, a very harrowing experience, a tough thing that you go through. You're never going to come out the same, but you have to go through it in order to come out the other side. And those transformations, I think, make us better people if we're willing to face them. Suffering deepens our capacity for compassion. At least it did for me. And that's what I'd hope people see in the book as well.
I'm thinking about the antagonist in your book, your brother's wife. And you don't disguise your feelings toward her. And I want to know, how as writers should we handle antagonists, maybe in real life, but also on the page?
When I teach creative nonfiction, I use this podcast. It's the writer Ann Hood, and the title of the podcast is How to Write a Kick-Ass Essay. I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. One thing she says, one of her rules is you shouldn't write to glorify or mythologize someone, and you also shouldn't write to get revenge or to villainize someone. Probably the smartest thing that she says about character in that little snippet where she explores that tenet is, as a writer, it's really your job to put the person out there in all their specificity without judgment. Say what you saw, say who they are, stick to the details. The reader will make they'll come to their own conclusion, but it's just your job to portray them as you knew them in great detail and without judgment. That's what I've tried to do.
Yeah.
And my feelings are part of that equation. As a character in the book myself, I'm the narrator, so those feelings are relevant. But even those feelings aren't linked to that antagonist being necessarily a bad person. So it's not a judgment in that sense, but just trying to capture the whole experience and all its specificity and put it out there for others to draw their own conclusions.
My last question is a two-parter. What's driving you these days, and what are you driving?
Oh, that's great. What's driving me these days? Love has to be at the top as my motivating force. And that's a very cheesy answer. But I do believe if you put career, self-interest, anything like that, whatever it might be, at the top of your goals, you'll never have enough. You'll always be hungry. My kids are at beautiful ages right now, 8 and 11. And one of my main driving forces is to sit down and do my creative work every day. I'm working on another book because that's where I feel most like myself. That's what fills up my cup, and that's what makes my days meaningful. And the other part of that is with my off time, going on great adventures with my kids while they'll still tolerate me.
Yeah.
And so what I'm driving these days, I have a little habit. I have two Volkswagen camper vans. I have a 2002 Eurovan Weekender. That means it has two beds and it actually runs, and that's our daily driver. And then I have the van that appears in the epilogue of this book, which is a 1984 Volkswagen camper van, the full camper with the kitchen. And I got that when my kids are 2 and 5, and now they've grown up with it. So when summer hits in Montana, we take that van out and about and go try to explore and have fun.
Melissa Stevenson resides in Missoula, Montana, where she writes in three genres and drives two camper vans. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.